I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Protesters disrupted yesterday's confirmation hearing for John Brennan to be the director of the CIA. After five interruptions, Senator Dianne Feinstein cleared the room of the Code Pink peace activists who were protesting the administration's use of drones for targeted killings. Brennan, who has been President Obama's lead counterterrorism advisor, justified the program, saying that it is only used as a last resort to save lives. A group of bipartisan senators had complained that the Obama administration had refused to share information about the drone program, and earlier in the week, a leaked memo shed light and raised some questions about the targeting of Americans with alleged ties to Al-Qaeda. Our topic for today's Radio Times. Our guests are Gregory McNeil, professor at Pepperdine University. He specializes in law, policy, and security, also a Forbes contributor, joining us from the studios of Pepperdine. And Greg McNeil, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. It's nice to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. Also with us is Noreen Shah, Associate Director of the Counterterrorism and Human Rights Project at the Human Rights Institute of Columbia Law School. And Noreen Shah, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
Noreen, let me begin with you. What question would you have asked John Brennan yesterday?
Well, you know, a lot of the questions that were asked were really the right questions to ask. But what I would have wanted to know from John Brennan is, how is he determining who is collateral damage? He mentioned going through agony, you know, at making sure that there's no collateral injuries and deaths from the drone strikes. And Senator Feinstein mentioned that the numbers that they're getting are that civilians who are killed in drone strikes are in the single digits. But the problem that's been plaguing this description of the drone program as extremely precise is that we don't know who they're defining and how they're defining who can be killed in drone strikes and who can't be. And that has a real impact for the people who are living in these conflict zones. They aren't sure what's going to get them killed by a drone strike. What kind of conduct? Is it just meeting with people who are identified as militants? Is it cooperating with them in some way? And that's the real problem. If we don't know who's being killed, we don't know how the U.S. is determining who to kill, then I don't know if we can really trust these claims of low collateral damage.
Do you have a sense or an idea of how many civilians have been killed by drone strikes?
Well, what we know is that a May 2012 report by the New York Times quoted a senior government official as saying that the U.S. counts all military-age males in a strike zone to be militants, to be combatants. And that's a really worrying standard under international humanitarian law. That wouldn't be the standard. You presume that people who you don't know, you presume that those people would be civilians. And instead, the Obama administration is taking the opposite point of view, that if we don't know who we're targeting, then we assume that the people who we mean to be targeting. It's just a really circular kind of reasoning, and it's pretty scary.
Gregory McNeil, let me get you to respond to what Noreen Shah just said, her concern about civilians that may be targeted and may be killed by these drone strikes. Do you share her concern?
I think we have some agreement, at least on the first part, with regard to the transparency of the categories of individuals that the United States government says it will target. We know broadly that the United States government is looking to target individuals who are members of or associated with Al-Qaeda. The associated forces is the term that the government uses. However, we're not really sure what the scope of that term is, and so there could be some greater transparency there. With regard to the quote about military-aged males, it's interesting that we've only seen that quote in straight news reporting once, and it hasn't reappeared in news reporting, I think because it was the way it was reported was somewhat convoluted, in that I think what the anonymous government official who was quoted was trying to say was that not that the United States government would target all military-aged males in a strike zone, but that after the fact, when counting whether an individual was a civilian, or after the fact counting them as collateral damage, whether they were a militant, the operating assumption would be people who weren't anticipated prior to the strike, who were military-aged males, would be counted as collateral damage.
Well, Gregory McNeil, let me ask you a larger question. Do you think the executive branch, the White House, has the right to carry out targeted killings?
I believe they do. The United States government, all three branches agree that the United States is in an armed conflict. Congress passed after the September 11th attacks an authorization for the use of military force. That authorization was acted on by President Bush and by President Obama. The Congress has consistently reauthorized funds for all of the broad scope of government activity that the executive branch is involved in. And the courts have had multiple opportunities to look at, not at targeted killing specifically, but to look at the detention operations that the United States government's involved in and says, yes, the United States government is involved in an armed conflict with Al-Qaeda and associated forces.
And I do want to get to you, Noreen, but let me go back to you, Greg. This is an operation that is carried out by the CIA and has been referred to as a clandestine war. Are you concerned about the fact that there's much we don't know about what's going on with these drone strikes?
Yeah, I am. It's a bit remarkable that the administration took so long to release this white paper that wasn't really that informative and has also taken so long to defend the process, because it's actually my running assumption here is that it's more defensible than what they're giving it credit for. And so it is a bit surprising to me that there is a lack of transparency. And that's just, I think, tied to, as you suggest, the fact that the CIA carries out many of the operations. But as Noreen's pointed out, JSOC, Special Operations, also carries out some of these operations too. And so it's not just the CIA that's conducting these strikes.
Noreen, I'd love to have you weigh in on this as well. In terms of the executive branch and whether they have the right or not to carry out this clandestine war.
You know, what's troubling about the executive branch carrying it out without a lot of public scrutiny by Congress is that we don't have the opportunity to really closely scrutinize what's happening here. I just want to go back to these terms, collateral damage and strike zone, because I think they tend to dehumanize the people and the places that we're talking about. So take the October 14, 2012 strike that killed Abdul Rahman, the 16-year-old U.S. citizen who was killed in a drone strike. Now, he was 16 years old. His 17-year-old cousin was also killed. They were apparently having a barbecue. They were both, you know, according to this military age male presumption, after they were killed, they would be counted as militants presumptively. And, in fact, media outlets after the strike reported that Abdul Rahman, who was 16, they reported that he was 5 years older than that, and that, like his father, Anwar al-Awlaki, that he was a high-value al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula figure. In fact, you know, it came out later, because his grandfather is also a U.S. citizen, that this was a 16-year-old guy. He had a U.S. birth certificate that showed he was 16 years old. He had never had anything to do with anything. And the strike was actually not meant to kill the 16-year-old or the 17-year-old. It was meant to kill al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula's media chief, an Egyptian named Ibrahim al-Banna, and that guy wasn't killed. But, so, you know, we hear about collateral damage, right. We hear about strike zones. It sounds very clean and very precise, and you want to trust the Obama administration to be making decisions, but any kind of strike is fallible. And the claim of such low collateral damage in a drone strikes war that has been, you know, more than 400 strikes, more than 3,000 people killed, these claims of extremely low collateral damage just are hardly tenable. Has got to be examined.
But I'm wondering, and this is an awkward comparison, but compare drone strikes and a bombing campaign, for instance. And we know in bombing campaigns there are civilians who die. They may not be targeted, but they're there and they pay a price. How do you wrestle with that, Noreen?
I think it's an unfair comparison. Look, I don't have a problem with drone technology per se. I do think, though, that drone technology makes us go into war zones that we wouldn't go into otherwise. Think about whether or not we would even be in Yemen. Would we be in, you know, Somalia for some of these strikes? Would we be in Pakistan if it wasn't for drones? And if we were going into those places, the Obama administration would have to go on television, justify why we're sending planes over Yemen. We would have to have a much larger public debate. President Obama wouldn't be able to stand up in a second inauguration and talk about ending wars when he's really introduced the U.S. into new conflict zones under his first term.
Well, and picking up on that, and Noreen, we're going to call you back. We're losing a little bit of you on our phone line. We want to make sure you're on a better phone line. But, Greg, let me just pick up on that. And we are talking about targeting individuals who are in countries with whom we are not at war. How do you wrestle with that?
Yeah, you know, the fact that we're not at war with these countries really is not that significant of a point to me. The United States government sees itself involved in an armed conflict with Al-Qaeda and associated forces. The legal authority they're citing in support of this is the authorization for use of military force that gives the president the authority to go after Al-Qaeda and associated forces. So the war that the United States sees itself involved in is against these non-state actors. actors, and the United States sees the war extending to wherever those individuals may be. There's nothing in any court case or any legislation that geographically restricts the scope of the conflict. The geography challenge that comes up is, have Yemen, Pakistan, and the arguable government of Somalia consented to our operations in those countries? And that's really where things start to get muddy. It seems like Yemen has, and Pakistan, I would argue, has as well. However, they want to have it both ways. They want to criticize U.S. operations for domestic, their domestic political consumption, while at the same time accepting large amounts of foreign aid from the United States government, and also deriving some benefits from the strikes that the United States government is conducting.
Let me quote something from Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat from Oregon, and has been a part of a number of members of the U.S. Senate, saying that the Obama administration has not been forthcoming enough about this targeted killing program. And he says the laws in our country and their interpretations are not supposed to be confidential. The idea of keeping the Intelligence Committee in particular out of any real oversight or insight into the legal analysis, it's a mockery of the oversight process. Do you think, Greg McNeil, that members of the U.S. Congress should have oversight responsibilities?
I do, and they have oversight responsibilities, and historically, intelligence operations and the intelligence community has revealed to the House and Senate intelligence committees the information they've wanted to reveal to them, and then ignored them at other times, not just in drone strikes, but in surveillance context and whatnot. And there's a reason for this. It's that the intelligence committees don't have appropriation powers over the intelligence agencies, and so the strongest tool the intelligence committees have would be to cut off funding to any congressional committee would be to cut off funding, but they don't have a say in the appropriations process. They might have one member who sits on appropriations for intelligence, and not much time is spent on it. There have been legislative efforts to try and reform this, and it's a turf battle in Congress, and no congressman wants to give up the power of the purse or distribute it to other individuals. And so that's part of the reason why Wyden's concerns are so salient.
Well, we're almost up in a break here, but there's financial side, but isn't there also legal oversight that's a responsibility of the U.S. Congress?
Sure. Yeah. I agree. It's their responsibility. What I'm saying is we can understand how it's hard for them to exercise that responsibility because the intelligence community can dodge them and stonewall them. This is what we saw with the legal reasoning about the drone strikes and the memos not being released until just 2 days ago.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. And that's Gregory McNeil. He's a professor at Pepperdine University, specializing in law, policy, and security. He's also a Forbes contributor. Also with us, Noreen Shah. We got her back on what we hope is a better phone. Associate Director of the Counterterrorism and Human Rights Project at the Human Rights Institute of Columbia Law School. And we are talking about drone strikes and targeted killings. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Open Connections, a progressive educational environment, supports WHYY. At Open Connections, youth ages 2 through 18 attend programs 1 to 3 days a week from September to June. Guided by their principles of respect, freedom, responsibility, and natural learning, Open Connections serves as a community base for young people and their families seeking an innovative, collaborative, and process-conscious educational environment. An open house at their campus in Newtown Square is Sunday, February 10th at 4 p.m. Details at openconnections.org.
I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and we want to end this winter membership drive today, and we can do that when you make a pledge of support. This week on Radio Times, Al Gore and Philadelphia Police Commissioner Charles Ramsey were our guests. We also talked about the fiscal crisis, dogs, cats, school closures in Philadelphia, the roots of the Vietnam War, soul food, and today, the debate over drones and an interview about the Pulitzer Prize-winning opera Silent Night. That's one program here at WHYY and just 1 week's worth of interviews. That's what we do. Now, here's what you need to do. Pick up the phone and make a call right now and make a pledge at 1-888-345-9499. You can also pledge online at WHYY.org. For a $60 pledge, we will send you the delightful and very cool-looking Radio Times anniversary mug designed by Pulitzer Prize winner Tony Auth. You decide what this news and information is worth and make a call. 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. Thanks. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And today in this hour, we are examining the country's drone policy and its targeted killing program, the questions it raises about international law, human rights, executive power, government transparency, and foreign policy. Our guests are Noreen Shah from the Human Rights Institute of Columbia Law School and Gregory McNeil, professor at Pepperdine University. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Noreen, let me go back to you and something that you wrote recently about this program, that you would feel more comfortable if it were under the U.S. military and not under the CIA. Explain what your reasoning is there.
Well, it's right now it's being run by the CIA. It's also being run by the White House, and the White House is working with the military, and the Joint Special Operations Command is also involved. The Joint Special Operations Command is a highly secretive organization within the military. It's actually probably more secretive than the CIA, especially in terms of its requirements to report its activities to Congress. So we have two highly secretive organizations, the CIA and Joint Special Operations Command, neither of which were really built to be taking the lead in a war. They don't have that kind of relationship to the public, to transparency, to reporting their activities outside of, you know, a very limited sphere of policymakers in D.C., and I think that's what makes them inappropriate to be taking the lead. I think it's really hard to know with Joint Special Operations Command exactly what they're doing, and that's part of the problem. I mean, not even reporters who've been looking into this for the last 2 years could tell you exactly what Joint Special Operations Command relationship is to the Department of Defense in terms of the chain of command. Now, the conventional military forces, by which I just mean the forces that were for the most part in Iraq and Afghanistan, though Joint Special Operations Command was there as well. These military forces, of course, we know they commit abuses. That's happened, but it's sometimes soldiers within the conventional military forces that report those abuses. We hear about those abuses, and that's what's really important. Mistakes are going to be made in war, but the public's got to have the chance to learn about them.
What do you think about that, Greg McNeil?
So one of the reforms that I propose in a paper that I'm working on is greater reporting on the mistakes that are happening. So if the military prior to any strike occurring, the military or the intelligence community will do an estimate of what they think the likely collateral damage from that strike would be. And then after the fact, they're supposed to do a battle damage assessment where they'll stay overhead in the drone and they'll try and count individuals. You do this because you want to make sure that you hit your target, and you also do it because you're concerned about civilian casualties. That data doesn't have to be reported on a strike-by-strike basis as they occur, but you would think that data could be reported somehow to Congress, and Congress could mandate that it be reported. I think that type of transparency is the type of thing that Noreen and I could agree about. We should know whether the United States government is effective or not in these strikes. We're spending a lot of money on them. A lot of lives are on the line. A lot of innocent people may be getting killed. Why shouldn't we know about the performance data of what our government's doing?
But do you think, Noreen, that there's a place for covert warfare?
No, I don't. As a human rights lawyer, I think it's anti-democratic. I think that there's questions about whether a secret war is a war that this government wants to be taking.
We got to get her on a better phone line. I'm sorry about this, Noreen. We got to call you back, but we're missing almost every other word that she says. So we'll get Noreen Shah back on what we hope is a better phone line. To you, Gregory McNeil, the same question: is there a place for a covert war?
You know, sure, there's certainly a place for covert action. It's written into our law. It's been in our law since 1947, the authority for the intelligence community to engage in other actions. And the process by which it happens is the president makes a covert action finding and sends that information to the Congress to let them know that he's determined that there's a need for covert action to protect the national security or foreign relations interests of the United States. And so I think what wasn't anticipated is the scale of operations that the CIA is currently involved in. And just to take up the point that the question you had asked Noreen about whether it should be more under the military versus under the CIA, The military, as Noreen said, doesn't have to report its strikes, whereas the CIA has to report in writing each of the covert actions that it's engaged in. So the CIA is somewhat more accountable to the Congress in that fashion. But as I mentioned earlier, they're less accountable because it's harder for Congress to rein in, using the power of the purse, the activities of the intelligence community, whereas the House and Senate Armed Services Committee, if they make a decision to want greater transparency from the military, they can oftentimes cut off line by line parts of the Department of Defense budget. And so DOD is very responsive to congressional oversight, more so than the intelligence community is.
But do you think as we look into the 21st century that more and more there's going to be greater reliance on drones and perhaps even less use of sending in, you know, the army and invading a country?
I think that would be certain policymakers' preferences. I think that'll be limited in part by the fact that if you look at where we are engaged in these types of drone strikes, they're in places that are geographically remote, that like we use them in Libya, we're using them in North Africa, in places where we would rather not commit troops. But in the big, large wars that are going to be major threats to the United States, drones alone are not going to be the way that we conduct these types of conflicts.
Noreen Shah, hopefully we have you on a better line. But are you concerned? I know some are concerned that these drone strikes and even the drones hovering over certain areas have turned people against the United States. Have you found evidence of that?
No, I personally don't have evidence of that. I mean, that's something that people who are, you know, policy experts in Yemen and Pakistan, they found some evidence of that. I think it's really hard to tell. These are areas of the world where conflict is ongoing, and there's already, you know, some amount of public anger, public distrust. I think that the biggest problem is that we're distorting the public debate and the political process in these other countries insofar as we're intervening and doing it in a semi-secret way. You know, who knows what effect this will have on the political legitimacy of the Pakistani government to have a kind of, we know that they're here, but we don't provide them consent, but kind of we do. That attitude that the Pakistani government has got to have to allow the U.S. to continue drone strikes, it's just distorting the process, probably not helping shore up the legitimacy of that democracy.
I'm curious, Noreen, and perhaps this is too much of a speculative question, but why do you think the Obama administration is doing what it's doing and largely keeping this program secret and responding only to pressures, whether from the press or from Congress?
Well, I think the reason the program started out as being a secret in Pakistan is because the Pakistani government did not want to be an open war. They didn't want to admit that they were colluding with the United States in these drone strikes for political reasons, dealing with their own, own citizenry. The reason why it continues to be an open secret, I think, is because that's the way it started. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be cynical about the Obama administration's reasons, because this administration has repeatedly said how committed it is to transparency. We heard that from Mr. Brennan in a hearing yesterday again. And it's a question of them making good on that commitment to openness.
Gregory McNeil, Senator Feinstein said yesterday, or seemed to intimate yesterday, that there might be a role for a kind of a FISA court or judge to overlook this drone strike program. Does that make sense to you?
It does make sense to me, although I wouldn't hold out much hope for this to be the big reform that human rights advocates are looking for. It's unlikely that the That the review would happen sort of as strikes are occurring. It's more likely that it would be, let's review the names on the list and whether or not those names are appropriately on the list. But what is a judge going to do? A judge is going, if it's like a FISA court, mm-hmm. It's an ex parte proceeding. So the government's going to walk in with their experts and their intelligence file. And they're going to say, here are all of the pieces of evidence that we have. And a judge, a lawyer, not trained in law of armed conflict or in anything related to intelligence, is going to look at these experts and ask a couple of non-expert questions and make some determination about whether or not the government has done their due diligence. I'm not confident that it would do anything other than be political avoidance for the executive branch and the legislature to say, look, these courts signed off on it. Things are okay. And I don't think that's what we want. I think the political pressure is a good thing.
But do you think the Obama administration is saying, trust us? You know, we have the knowledge, the wherewithal, the responsibility to make these correct calls.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what they're saying. And that's what the Bush administration said, too. And that's an outgrowth of our political system that says that we trust the executive branch and the political branches, the executive and the legislature, to make these types of decisions in warfare. And the courts themselves have said, we stay out of these. These are not questions that are entrusted to Article III courts. These are entrusted to the political branches.
And that's Gregory McNeil, again, professor at Pepperdine University, specializing in law, policy, and security. Also a contributor to Forbes. Noreen Shah with us as well, associate director of the Counterterrorism and Human Rights Project at the Human Rights Institute of Columbia Law School. And we are talking about the Obama administration's use of drones for targeted killings, including the killings of Americans abroad. I do want to talk more about that. John Brennan, the nominee for CIA director, talked about that some yesterday, was asked about that by some of the senators, and there were protests at his confirmation hearing. Those members of Code Pink who have criticisms and concerns of this targeted killing program, and we are looking at the country's drone policy, the questions it raises about things like international law, human rights, executive power, government transparency, and foreign policy. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Noreen, let me put that trust me question to you. Should we trust the Obama administration?
I just don't think that we can. As much as we would like to, it would be irresponsible for the American public and for Congress and for the courts to defer completely to the Obama administration. The one thing that the Code Pink activists pointed out yesterday was that we don't even know. We don't even have Congress getting information from Mr. Brennan, from the government, about where we're conducting these strikes. Mr. Brennan refused again to provide a list of the countries where we're conducting drone strikes. If you cannot provide a list of the countries, and we think we know what all those countries are, Yemen, Somalia, and Pakistan, but he will not provide that list to Congress, then what does that mean about the state of our democracy and our ability to really test what the government is doing and have a role in it as the public? And we've got to have that role in the democracy.
Go ahead, Greg.
So I saw this entire debate as it played out as actually raising hopes for human rights groups and for this political process. If you look at the evolution of transparency in the drone strike program, we went from really limited transparency when it began to a series of speeches by high-level Obama administration officials to now the leaking of this white paper. But the leaking of the white paper and the continued pressure of human rights groups over the past few years has forced the Obama administration to release the OLC memos to Congress. And I'm actually pretty confident that sustained political pressure will force greater transparency on them. And I think that those are good developments, and it's the type of thing that we want to have. Now, the fact that it took so long, I think, is just that's the way the political process works. It takes a while for interest groups to force legislators to actually take some action.
But why do you think, Greg, the Obama administration didn't want to share this information?
I think that's the nature of government secrecy in these types of operations, that it provides for you much greater freedom of action if you don't have to report this information. And if the public isn't clamoring for it and interest groups aren't forcing you to do it, it allows you greater freedom of action to mm-hmm. not put the information out. I'm actually more cynical about the Obama administration's motives than Noreen mm-hmm. is. I think that their rhetoric isn't matching their action. And I think that it makes sense for that to be the case. But, you know, I'm not that hopeful about big change.
But what, do you think there's something nefarious going on?
No, I don't think that it's nefarious. I think that that the executive branch, no matter which party it is, always wants to preserve its flexibility in military affairs and in intelligence operations, and seeks to report as little about that activity as possible.
Noreen, let me introduce something else. And, of course, part of this white paper that was released released earlier this week talks about the government targeting U.S. citizens. Quote, if an informed high-level official essentially decides that this target is a high-ranking al-Qaeda figure or is associated with al-Qaeda and poses, quote, an imminent threat of violent attack against the United States, and if capturing him is not feasible, then he can be killed, targeted by these drone strikes. There's been much made about this word, imminent threat of violent attack. I'd be curious about your response to this white paper.
Well, what you read sounds pretty good. I think that the bigger context here is that we're talking about the executive branch having this authority, which sounds a lot like battlefield commander decision-making, but having that authority for a war that spans the whole globe and for a war that's gone on for more than 10 years and for which there's no end in sight. So the question is, when does that kind of authority stop, first of all? Does it ever stop in the foreseeable future or in the foreseeable geographic distance? And the second question is, how does the Obama administration end up defining imminence? And when you turn the next couple pages of this White House white paper, mm-hmm. you see that the word imminence is defined to have nothing really quite to do with imminence. That's just a white paper. It's a summary of a much longer memo that we still haven't gotten to see. And that's another problem, that the Obama administration, now it's given the full memo to members of Congress. It won't give it to the staffers of Congress. They don't get to see it, and they're the ones we know who would actually do the analysis and have time to do it. And, of course, the public still doesn't get to see it, and we still don't really know how the administration is defining imminence. This is a 2-year-old memo that relates to a U.S. citizen who's an operational leader. The vast majority of strikes are not targeting U.S. citizens, and they're not targeting operational leaders. So what's happening with them?
Well, Greg, do you think someone that has alleged ties to al-Qaeda could and should be targeted by the U.S. drone strikes?
I think that's what the Congress anticipated when it's authorized the United States to use force and when it's continuously appropriated funds for that purpose. With regard to the imminence, if you read on the first page of the memo, the introduction to the memo states that it's actually on page 2 that imminence is actually part of the due process analysis. And so if you're an American citizen, this might make you feel better because you have to be an imminent threat. However, if you're concerned more broadly about the way the United States targets, the imminence thing isn't going to make you feel much better at all, because the United States doesn't require imminence for its targeting of al-Qaeda members who are not U.S. citizens. In fact, the U.S. position is that it will target individuals who are members of al-Qaeda and associated forces. So the process is a membership determination mm-hmm. to figure out who will be the subject of a strike.
We're almost up in a break here, but are you saying, Greg, that if a U.S. citizen allies him or herself with al-Qaeda, they have lost all their constitutional protections?
That's the reasoning of the Obama administration. Not that they've lost them. The Obama administration concedes that due process is appropriate, that we should analyze due process. However, in the circumstances of a U.S. citizen joining al-Qaeda, serving in an operational role with operational planning in a geographically restricted area where al-Qaeda controls forces, that person would the due process analysis would allow that person to be targeted.
That's Gregory McNeil, Professor Pepperdine University, Noreen Shaw from the Human Rights Institute of Columbia Law School. Both of them joining us today in Radio Times. We're talking about the use of drones for targeted killings, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
In Philadelphia, everyone is reading The Buddha in the Attic by Julie Otsuka, a poetic novel that traces the collective experiences of Japanese picture brides from the turn of the 20th century to the onset of World War II. A joint project of the Office of the Mayor and the Free Library of Philadelphia, One Book, One Philadelphia features 8 weeks of discussions, performances, and workshops through March 13th. Details at freelibrary.org/onebook. The Free Library of Philadelphia supports WHYY.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're in what we hope is the final stretch of the winter membership campaign. If you haven't made a pledge of support, if your membership has lapsed, if you're new to WHYY and new to public media, we need your financial support. That's how we fund about half of what we do here at WHYY. You decide the value and then make a pledge. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499, and you can pledge online at WHYY.org. Today on Radio Times, we're hosting a debate and discussion over the use of drones and targeted killings. That's an issue that's been in the news lately. And we're introducing you to the composer and librettist of the Pulitzer Prize-winning opera Silent Night and a tenor who's performing at the Academy of Music tonight. Where else do you get that kind of diverse and in-depth programming? Only on WHYY, and because we have the time, only on Radio Times. 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. Make that pledge. Thanks so much. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are examining the U.S. drone policy with Noreen Shaw and Gregory McNeil. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499, an issue that has much been in the news this week. Let me get Cyril from Guatemala to join us on Radio Times. And Cyril, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you.
You're welcome.
I think it's important to emphasize that these are just suspects. And, you know, I'd like the guests to talk a little bit more about the due process. And if you look record with intelligence, and I'll use the Extraordinary Rendition Program under the Bush administration as an example, you can point to Maher Arar, the Canadian citizen who was wrongly identified as a terrorist, kidnapped and sent to Syria, and tortured for 6 months. And it turned out that he was completely innocent and they had mixed up his names. And so these are some of the dangers that come with this program. And unfortunately, when someone's killed and intelligence comes out that, in fact, they were innocent, it's kind of hard to bring that back.
Cyril, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Noreen, let me put that to you, the issue of suspects and what the U.S. does. Go ahead.
Well, first, you know, the white paper is interesting because the analysis of due process brings in a lot of concepts from international law that don't actually have to do with due process. But the Obama administration also quotes a case called Hamdi. And Hamdi was a case about detention. And essentially what Hamdi says is that there doesn't have to be a pre-capture due process, because after the fact, if you got it wrong, you could just find out who the guy was once he was in detention and then release him. Mm-hmm. Drone strikes don't allow that. So when we're talking about terrorism suspects in the context of detention or prosecuting people, we might want to, you know, consider how different that is from having a suspect who we killed. The problem with a drone is that it sets the standard as, you know, lethal. We're going to kill this person. We never find out who they are when it actually matters. We find out after the fact, after they've already been killed. And that's what's so dangerous. And that's why we need to have a higher standard for who we kill than who we detain. And that's what it looks like in international law, and we want to make sure that it's also the case here when it comes to the U.S.'s targeted killing practices.
Go ahead, Greg.
The interesting development here is that there's been such an emphasis on killing over captures. This came up in the Brennan hearings yesterday, where Brennan, you know, tried to say that, you know, we always try and capture people. That's always our preference. And I just think the historical record shows that that's not the case. Mm. And why is that? If you're planning out a military operation or intelligence operation, it's a lot more difficult administratively, right? I'm just being very cynical here, to capture people than it is to kill them. If the drone is overhead with surveillance and it has a missile, why would you send a team in and risk losing that team and risk the diplomatic and political fallout of having boots on the ground in an area when you could launch a missile. The reason you wouldn't is human rights or humanitarian concerns, but those are always going to be balanced on the ledger against military and operational concerns, and they're always going to lose unless there's some significant intelligence value to be derived from capturing an individual. And even then, how are you going to get the intelligence from that person? And so, you know, I think the caller brings up a really good point, and it's clear that our policy has gone towards preferring kills over captures.
But even picking up on this intelligence issue, Greg, which is having the right right enough intelligence to know who can be targeted and who clearly is affiliated and allied with Al-Qaeda, for instance.
Yeah, so there's no doubt that mistakes happen in any targeting operation or can happen in any targeting operation. There has been quite an evolution, though, in the last few years with the pattern of life analysis that the military engages in. And it's, you know, for callers, just think if someone flew a drone overhead that you weren't aware was there and it followed you everywhere that you went for 2 weeks. At the end of that 2 weeks, this person might actually know whoever's following you, and they know your phone calls and who you interact with. They might actually know who you are and where you work and who you're affiliated with a pretty high degree of certainty. That's not to say that mistakes don't happen, but the process, the pattern of life analysis can actually be pretty accurate when you look at how it's conducted.
Noreen, I'm curious, and then I do want to get back to our callers, but let's say the U.S. has identified someone and they have clear evidence that they are affiliated with a terrorist organization who's in intent is to attack the United States. And we're talking about an individual here. What should the U.S. do?
Well, first, I just want to go back to this pattern of life analysis and the idea of a drone hovering overhead with a person not knowing it. People know. And in these villages where there's drones hovering overhead, it scares everyone in that village. People don't want to send their children outside. It causes severe psychological damage to the people who are living in these communities. It puts those communities at risk of retaliation because militant groups view those communities as suspect, as possibly providing information, as possibly being spies for the CIA. And we know that there's been cases of torture, of beheading by militant groups in retaliation for supposed collusion of local communities with the CIA. Now, the ultimate responsibility is with those militant groups for doing that. But we're not talking about a clean, precise war where we just go in, hover overhead for 2 weeks, kill somebody, and then leave without causing any harm to the local population. This is definitely impacting people in the countries where we're doing this. And there's a cost-benefit analysis to be made about it. But let's be honest about the cost to the people who are living there.
What, but I am curious about, you know, what does the U.S. do about an individual that they have evidence has intent to harm U.S. citizens or attack the country, for instance?
Now, this has always been the narrative of drone strikes, that we've got a kill list. We've identified the worst of the worst. We cross the T's and dot the I's, make sure that they're the bad guy, and then we go after them with the drone. The fact is that more than 3,000 people have been killed in drone strikes, more than 400 drone strikes as of today. And it's hard to believe that all of those drone strikes are targeting these kinds of individuals who you're mentioning in this hypothetical. Now, you know, to answer it clearly, I do think that we should be trying to capture these kinds of individuals. If we know that somebody poses an imminent threat, if they are actually plotting an attack against the United States, don't we want to know where that attack is? Don't we want to know about his associates? We should probably want to interrogate this person, and we can interrogate them in a humane way. The FBI interrogates people, and sometimes there's abuses there, but it's a better way to interrogate people, and it's a way that often works.
Well, I guess you're talking about special forces. Go ahead, Greg, and then I do want to get to our callers.
I'm sorry. I just needed to push back on one of the numbers that Noreen is citing, and lots of human rights advocates say this. They say 3,000 people have been killed in drone strikes. But of those 3,000, and this is using the Bureau of Investigative Journalism's numbers, not government numbers, and the BIJ is not exactly in favor of drone strikes, they cite that only between 474 and 881 of those killed were civilians. It's still a high number, but when you boil it down, that's between 0.8 and 2.5 civilians per strike. So it's not like thousands of people are being killed in each strike. I'm not minimizing that this isn't a tragedy when civilians are killed, but to cite the 3,000 number really sort of distorts the per strike casualty numbers, which are relatively low compared to almost any other type of military strike that you could have.
Actually, let me get Sylvia from Kensington to join our conversation. And Sylvia, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just going to talk about the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, because they're saying that the number killed is like at least three times what the CIA is telling us. So right away, the CIA is not being honest. They're downplaying it. And when, from everything I read, the people in Pakistan are beginning to hate the United States because of all the civilians that are killed. So I think it's counterproductive. We're making more enemies. But, you know, for me, even more than that is I think it's against our Constitution. It's against international law that people are found guilty without any kind of trial, without any kind of due process. And I think this is just an outrageous thing that the United States is doing. And I'm very disappointed, because I thought President Obama was going to stop these kinds of things. And instead, he's doing them even more than were done under President Bush.
Well, Sylvia, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give Greg a chance to respond to your criticism. Go ahead, Greg.
Yeah, I mean, the caller starts with the presumption that the Bureau of Investigative Journalism says this number, it's different from the CIA's number, therefore the CIA is lying. Well, how do I know that the Bureau of Investigative Journalism's number is any better than the CIA's number, especially when everyone admits that it's very, including the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, it's very difficult to gather civilian casualty numbers in these areas where individuals who are not allowed to be in those areas can't go, and that includes journalists. And so it's tough for us to say one number over another. And I'm just saying, arguing for the sake of argument, let's just accept the BIJ numbers, and you still get a relatively low number of civilians killed per strike.
That's Gregory McNeil, who joins us along with Noreen Shah. We are talking about drone strikes and targeted killings. Has been much in the news this week, and certainly the hearing yesterday, the confirmation hearing for John Brennan to be the director of the CIA, put another spotlight on this issue. I'm Marty Moscoane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get, looks like Kirby from Abington to join us. Kirby, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you? I'm
good.
A first-time caller to any station, really.
Oh,
I'm
good.
Listening, and I'm just wondering, say we have a domestic terrorist like Timothy McVeigh. Should he have been targeted? He ended up killing, say, 165 people. I mean, we worry about these foreign terrorists, and you know, even if they are American-born, they should be targeted, just as though I think Timothy McVeigh should have been if they had known.
Well, Kirby, interesting perspective. Let me see if Noreen Shah has thought about that. Noreen?
Yeah, I mean, one thing is that we use the term terrorist, and there was some slippage there in what Greg was saying about civilians killed and people killed. 3,000 people killed, according to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, 400 to 800 of those people civilians. Who are the rest of those people? Well, according to the Obama administration, drone strikes go after senior leaders of al-Qaeda. So how many thousands of senior leaders of al-Qaeda can there be? And how can we have decimated al-Qaeda in Pakistan, yet continue to need to conduct drone strikes with relative frequency? But the numbers, you know, it is hard to make sense of them. And it is also the case that human rights groups do not know exactly who is being killed. I don't think the Bureau of Investigative Journalism knows who exactly is being killed either, because these definitions of these terms, terrorist, militant, civilian, They're really slippery. The Obama administration is defining them in ways that make it easy for it to conduct extensive targeting of individuals. Now, I think that Timothy McVeigh is probably a whole lot different from the average person who's being killed in a drone strike, not because that average person is definitely a civilian, because even if they're not a civilian, they're a military age male who might have recently joined up with a militant group. They're a low-level foot soldier, and does it really make sense for us to be waging a war where we're killing thousands of low-level foot soldiers and creating a lot of distrust within these communities and putting them at risk as well?
Well, Greg, let me turn back to you and kind of play off of Kirby's question, because I know one of the criticisms of the drone program is to say that if we're doing this in countries that we're frankly not at war with, what's to prevent a country from using drones over this country and looking at our civilian population?
Sure. Yes. Yeah. So the answer to your immediate question is that it's the same thing that if we tried to use drones in China, China would shoot our drones down. And so the things that prevent war in the state of the world as we see it, the real world, is that if Pakistan, for example, didn't want us flying drones in their country anymore, they would go to the UN and lodge a formal complaint rather than making these complaints they make to the media, and they would shoot the drones down, right? That, and they'd stop taking our money, and they'd say, you can't fly over our country anymore. With regard to Kirby's initial question about whether or not Timothy McVeigh could be targeted, under the legal authorities that currently exist, at least the statutory authorities, no. Someone like Timothy McVeigh is not a member of Al-Qaeda or Associated Forces, couldn't be targeted. Under the legal reasoning in the white paper, he couldn't be targeted because he's not in a location where Al-Qaeda or Associated Forces has a significant and organized presence. But there is this argument, and so I'm not making it. I'm just putting it out there because people have made it, that the president's inherent duty to protect the Constitution under to protect the country under the Constitution would authorize him to, in certain circumstances of imminence, kill individuals inside the United States. I'm not making the argument. I'm just repeating the argument. And the best example of this would be an airliner filled with civilians flying towards a building. Both the Obama and Bush administrations scrambled jets looking to shoot down that airliner and kill civilians who were likely Americans. It's never happened, but it seems that just even as a matter of practice, that authority is claimed. And I think that's what makes us so uncomfortable about the targeting of U.S. citizens, because many of us can see it as ourselves, and many Americans, sure, frankly, and sadly, don't have much concern for people in other countries. I'm not defending that. I'm just stating it as a matter of reality.
Noreen, we have about a minute or so before we have to say goodbye. I was looking at some polling finding that there was pretty dramatic, pretty overwhelming support for this drone program, even targeted killings. What would you like people who support these programs to think about?
I would like them to take a closer look at what it means to have targeted killing or a drone strike. I think it sounds great. It sounds like we've got a list of bad guys and we're going to take them out with some drones rather than putting our own servicemen and women at risk. But I don't think that's exactly what's happening. I think we need to know more. I think it's very dangerous for the Obama administration to have a blank check when it comes to drone wars, a kind of check it wouldn't have when it would come to war in Iraq or Afghanistan.
What about for you, Greg?
I think it would be important for us to have greater transparency with regard to the categories of individuals that the United States government thinks it should thinks it's allowed to target. I also think some other reforms, like the performance data, how are we doing? How many civilian casualties do we think were inflicted? Actual numbers on an annual basis. What's the cost of these particular strikes? And perhaps a reform might be to have an independent body appointed by the government, like a 9/11 type commission, review these strikes on an annual basis to say whether or not the policy is effective.
Well, Greg, thanks for getting up early and joining us today on Radio Times.
Sure.
And he's Gregory McNeil, professor of Pepperdine University, specializing in law, policy, and security, also a Forbes contributor. Noreen Shah, sorry about those phone problems, and thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Noreen Shah, Associate Director of the Counterterrorism and Human Rights Project at the Human Rights Institute of Columbia Law School. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us. Stay with us, though. We'll be right back.